Bonjour. Nous allons commencer cette première séance de l'après-midi qui, comme vous avez le voir, va se dérouler en anglais. Alors nous allons suivre le protocole qui m'a été indiqué. 15 minutes d'intervention par présentateur. Pas de discussion à la suite de chaque présentation, mais une discussion générale et qui pourra se faire, j'imagine, aussi bien en anglais qu'en français, puisque j'ai cru comprendre que chacun des présentateurs était en mesure de parler, ou en tous les cas de comprendre les questions en français. De toutes les manières, nous essaierons de nous débrouiller. Voilà. Eh bien, écoutez, pour ne pas prendre plus de temps, je passe tout de suite la parole à la première oratrice, qui s'appelle Asia Kubu, qui travaille à l'EHESS en master d'études politiques, et qui va nous parler de « Mapping Emotion in Social Movements, the Case of Gezi ».
There was a lot of people in the Taksim Square in 2013, and a lot of them were also middle-class people who were not politically active normally and who just suddenly became politically active. I'm from a generation that is famously apolitic, so when this happened it was quite surprising. And I think part of the story lies with the emotions, and I think it's helpful to look at what emotions were involved to understand better this movement. And I'll go from the beginning. On the 27th of May, there were bulldozers in Taksim to take down some trees because there will be a shopping mall to be constructed. And if you know Istanbul, there are already many shopping malls, so people thought that that wasn't necessary and they wanted to stop it. They were quite harshly treated. Their tents were burned at night, and there were people who took pictures and videos of this situation, and they circled this in social media, and that really brought about a lot of anger and a lot of outrage. And other people came to support this because they just thought it was so unjust. It was such a feeling of injustice was taking over. So other people came to support. And more, it became a really big movement. And so I think what really brought about the first reaction and the first gatherings is the anger and the outrage. And then there was... there was the feeling of really being scorned, because the next day the Prime Minister sadly made a speech that was quite down-looking and called the people just some environmentalists who don't really matter, and that just made the movement stronger. There was more anger, but what happened is in a few days, as everyone was there. And the media, they weren't covering this, what's going on there, even though there were people, a lot of people, and there was police was gassing the place, and no media coverage. So that just added to the anger and the outrage. But after that, the police was loosened a bit, so people started to be a little more calm in the square, and I think positive feelings really came about. Because everyone was there, and really people started to see each other as individuals. Very different identities were together. And then because there were these positive feelings, there more and more people came. And then this movement started to become a bigger problem because the Prime Minister was kind of getting a little bit angry too, just as the protesters got less angry. He called them scum and drunkards, and that just, that was actually re-owned by the protesters. They said, they just made these names their names, and they gave these words new meanings, good meanings, and they were proud to be called these words. So that just added to the positive feelings in the square. Pride and just really the joy of protesting. It wasn't like a... you know, it's hard to continue with a war, but if there are positive feelings of protest, then it just kind of gets easier to protest, basically. Elizabeth Wood calls this emotional in-process benefits of protesting, and she says this is what really is the key to the continuing, ongoing support to a movement. And just as they felt more proud and had more positive feelings about the movement, the square really turned into a festival. Of course, there are ways of making this square more have more positive feelings. One of which is music, also artistic performances, and it's kind of singing together and just being together and adding new collective interactions, rituals, adds to the positive feelings, but also it gives meaning to a protest. So, for example, these the songs that they sang together, they kind of changed the words and they made it their songs. They put in their names that they like. Scum was just, you know, in a song, and it was a good thing, for example. And also, what's really interesting, I think, is that very different people were there, very different identities, but also these identities were normally could be seen as mutually exclusive. For example, I am this, and you are that, and we're not supposed to be together. That's what normally people would think. But I think in the square, it really became something else. From this fixed mindset of not really, of the impossibility of coexisting, I think in the square, there was really conversation and dialogue that was concentrated on a growth mindset. So how can you grow me? How can I grow you? How can we grow as citizens and humans? And what kind of a world do we want? What kind of a country do we want to live in? And I think these were all practiced. And that's why it was so full of kind of really building up, constructing a new citizenship, and also just really humanity, because it's quite easy to stop seeing someone as human if they don't want what you want. But really, I think this is what sets apart this movement from the other movements in Turkey, because there really was this unique feeling. But what happened is, obviously, it wasn't clear, I guess, to the government that people didn't want to take them down. They just wanted to build something new, maybe some new way of living. And so the police became very violent and abused their force, which is really not really a unique case. Anyone with power can abuse power, and also people have been known to really inflict pain on others if they have the authority to do so. The famous Stanford experiment is shows this from the 80s. If you're interested, it's on YouTube, but I will stick to my subject. So the police became very violent, and that started the 4th of June, I think the first day of the first person dying. There was a child killed, which the death of a child is really something so unjust that, you know, most people really wouldn't understand how can this be justified, but obviously this raised a lot of anger, but it also raised a lot of sadness, which anger, I think, is a very powerful feeling. Sadness is a passive feeling. Anger drives action. Sadness really kind of prevents action, because you just get sad and you shut yourself in your little cell. And also there were really less and less positive feelings, because there was a lot of pessimism after these deaths and obviously a lot of injuries. So to justify the police and to justify this treatment, the protesters were accused of outrageous crimes, horrible crimes, and so, you know, just so that the force that was used on them could be legitimized. So the downlooking of the power turned into hatred, really. Now the protesters hated the government, and the rest of the people hated the protesters. So what really could be something very nice and nice is kind of a small word for this, but something that can be very transformative and positive for the society turned into something quite sad, and everyone ended up being quite pessimistic about it. So without the positive feelings, and with these sort of passive negative feelings, and with the loss of kind of hope, the movement slowly weakened and died, and that is kind of it, but I want to end with a positive note. I think what we should do is probably focus on what can we take from this, rather than why didn't we get any result, or why did it happen, why did it stop? I think maybe the process is more interesting and more worth looking at than the result or anything else. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup pour cette très brillante présentation qui nous plonge directement dans le débat. Alors déjà, ça m'évoque plein de choses. J'en parlerai après, mais d'emblée, un mot quand même, à quel point Sigmund Freud, que j'aime beaucoup, s'est trompé sur son analyse des foules. Mais là, c'est quand même assez stupéfiant de voir comment l'analyse des foules et l'analyse de l'émotion a quelque chose de totalement différent de ce que Freud pouvait imaginer. Je vous remercie vraiment beaucoup pour cette présentation. Je passe tout de suite la parole à Yula Shubgang, qui est maître de conférence à Paris-Ouest Nanterre et qui va aussi parler en anglais, malgré le fait qu'elle possède visiblement très bien le français, et qu'elle va nous parler de « From Revolutionaries to Volunteers, the Transformation Power of the Ukrainian Maidan Protest, Winter 2013-2014 ».
So in my presentation, I will try to reflect on the effects of participation in Maidan and Kyiv on ordinary participants. And by ordinary, I mean people who, prior to Maidan, didn't have any experience, any relationship with institutional or even street politics, actually. And just before I go to the presentation, I would like to remind you that Maidan, unlike all the other movements that were presented here, lasted almost 3 months. So it's a longer movement. As a social movement, and occupation also lasted 3 months, lived through two very tragic sequences, but violence was also present in other movements, and ended up with the same issue like Tahrir, also the downfall of the incumbent president. So I think that this question of 3 months is really important in relation with what I will be presenting. So I will proceed in three steps. I will focus firstly on revolutionary socialization that is underway on Maidan, socialization that actually provides a new identity, revolutionary identity to those ordinary people, and fosters their relationship with the nation also. I will then address the question of radicalization of those ordinary nonviolent revolutionaries who remained nonviolent for more than a month. And I will end up with this question of engagement, disengagement, and new forms of citizenship after Maidan. I usually rely on biographical analysis and participative observation, but in 15 minutes, of course, I would not be able to provide you some trajectories, but I will try to use some examples. So my first question, revolutionary socialization, how ordinary citizens became revolutionaries? And I would say that Maidan, and I think here we may have parallels with all other also public places, Maidan, its configuration and its settings may be considered as a kind of fabric of revolutionaries. Because they produce this mobilizing effect on them and provide them with this new identity, new sense of belonging to a community of revolutionaries. And this identity revolutionary, it's very lose identity, actually. It superimposes to all other identities. That's why I talk about parallels with other protest movements. If you see on this picture, for example, barricades, those kind of barricades are erected all around the perimeter of the occupied place, and the place is also bordered by 4 public buildings, 4 in the beginning, 5 later on, and you have also a tent city inside this space. So clearly here, barricades they play much more symbolic roles than a defensive, of course, because they provide this sense of strength, of determination to resist, and they also delimit a space. There is us revolutionaries within this revolutionary space, and people, especially those who come from regions, they live actually in this space, in the tents, on this public place, and them, the regime, its representatives, and this world of corruption, injustice, and arbitrary rule. And revolutionary socialization actually proceeds in two ways, I think, in Maidan, both vertically and horizontally. I'm sorry, I will bring some vertical elements also. We talk a lot about self-organization, horizontality, but I think also there are some vertical elements, and especially they were important in this revolutionary socialization. And one of the important elements of verticality is the scene. There was a huge scene in the middle of Maidan. Through this scene actually circulated senses, discourses on justice, rights, on the unity of the movement, on Europe, on the Ukrainian Europe, all the senses that made Maidan actually. And from this scene spoke not only politicians, but also established journalists, religious leaders, and sometimes, in the beginning at least, ordinary citizens also had right to speak from this scene. And there were different moments of gathering around this scene, Sunday, traditional gatherings, and every evening also there was a gathering, so kind of a special moment when senses circulated and were sent to protesters. And around the scene also all the festivities on Maidan, because Maidan was not also only about politics, it was also about festivity with concerts, especially in the night. So it was also on the scene and around the scene, which also provided a sense of community, you know, us all together around the scene. So revolutionary community ready to stand as long as citizens' claims are not fulfilled. And revolutionary community that also, to my mind, fosters the sense of belonging to a nation. What was striking for me when I arrived first in the beginning of December in Kyiv, I saw many, many people on Maidan standing and chanting the national anthem. And the images I had of the previous revolution in 2004, of course, the anthem was chanted also on Maidan, but not, you know, with such a frequency. And here from this scene, like every hour, there was an invitation to project oneself into the nation through this ritual of singing the anthem. So I think this national sense of belonging to a nation was also fostered through Maidan, even if Maidan had this illusion of being the nation, actually, and part of the nation remained outside and didn't recognize itself into this protest. So this is the element of vertical element, but there are also horizontality, of course, and I would stress the role of multiple self-organized microgroups. Nina told us about, Nina and Volodymyr, they told us about student assembly, which is a microgroup. There are numerous, you have more established groups such as self-defense groups, you have Automaidan, motorized citizens patrols, but you have also very minor groups. A group that gathered around a barrel, for example, where people did fire just to warm up during Maidan. Groups in the tents, and also like cooking initiatives attracting people, especially women who come and cook for Maidan protesters. So I think those microgroups enhanced also those revolutionary vocations, because it's through those groups that people acted. They found their place in the mobilization. And in those groups, sociability was very, very intense. So there was this sense of solidarity, of self-sacrifice, and also of unity, being all together through this small group, but with Maidan also. I just want to give you a quote of two of my respondents. Maybe the term is not correct, because I'm not asking them questions. I usually act with people. So they talked to me about their vision of my Automaidan, those motorized civil patrols, and they told me they praised this sense of mixity, you know, within Automaidan and solidarity. Some of us had a lot of money, others no. Some of us were just working as a taxi, but others were just in business. Some of us had Ford Sierra, an old model, and others a brand new Range Rover. But there was a solidarity between us, and this is something that is praised by those people. And also, I think those microgroups, they empower citizens and push them, you know, into different practices of citizenship. I have this example of a construction worker, Evgen. He's from Lutsk, and I've met him in different settings on Maidan, and ever since I've been following also his trajectory. And he joined a group of activists, Gromadsky sector activists that were in charge of part of logistics on Maidan, but also organized different actions, ludic and spectacular actions. Evgen was just affected to logistic tasks, but he assisted, you know, to the group meetings, discussions. He learned a lot also about political processes. And even if he talks to me, he uses this term of school of life. Maidan is a school of life for him, but I would paraphrase and say that it was a school of citizenship, actually, for him, because he felt himself as an important, as a citizen, and important at his levels. He told me at the beginning, when I was assisting to those meetings with all those intelligent persons, of course, I felt a little bit intimidated, shy, let's say. But with time, I understand that my word count also, and I even had the desire to speak also and to give my opinion, even if I was not so competent. And I think those microgroups and this sense, you know, kind of belonging created also an emotional affection and emotional link with the microgroup and Maidan. For example, Evgen was the one of the last, you know, of those who lived Maidan in the summer 2014. So I come to the question of radicalization, and I think I will not have time to go into all those factors that explains that ordinary citizens became radicalized. And by radicalization, I don't mean the use of violence. Actually, some of my respondents, they didn't use violence, but they were ready, you know, to use it if necessary, and they provided logistics to those who were in front lines and using violence. And there are several factors that may explain long-term factors, 1 month and a half and refusal of the president to do any concession, of course. There was a voting of repressive laws on January 16 by the Ukrainian parliament. And there were also constant aggressions against Maidan from the authorities, anti-riot police. But I would like to single out two factors that maybe talk to all of us, you know, all those who work on different places. First of all, the question of perception of violence, state violence. Of course, when the state violence is perceived as disproportionate and illegitimate, of course, there is a resistance also. And those kind of sense of disproportionate security response by the anti-riot police was there, and some of my respondents actually they were victims of this violence, especially a group of Automaidan. They were trapped by the police, beaten up, and then arrested. So this question of perception of state violence as disproportionate, but maybe another element which seems to me very important. Some of you told us about provocateur and the role of provocateurs, and I would state it like delegation of violence by the state towards non-state actors. And in case of Maidan, it was something broadly used by the power, because the regime recruited young guys, the term used in Ukrainian tetushki, recruited by the regime, equipped with bars, bats, and protected by the police when they were just spreading terror in Kyiv. And this kind of delegation of violence outraged even more than this disproportionate state response to protesters' violence, because we saw many people, and all of my respondents, they self-organized. They equipped themselves with bats also, so to patrol the streets outside the perimeter of Maidan, the center of Kyiv. And just one quotation also, because they had this sense of that the violence have erupted in their very inner space, you know, very private space. And just one quote, when some aggressive people operate just close to your house, when they enter your house and they seem to the city center of Kyiv is our house, of course you cannot, you know, stay and do nothing. Of course, when violence touches yourself and your environment, you engage. So when I was right after this first sequence in January in Kyiv, I saw this kind of transformation with my respondents. Nina also mentioned, you know, your military uniform. Some of my respondents who were wearing civilian civilian clothes in December, they started wearing military uniform, balaclavas. They changed their construction safety helmets with military helmets. So those small elements, you know, relation with objects, but proved to me that there is radicalization underway. The desire, you know, just maybe not to make violence, but to resist violence. Yes, of course. We may use the term of militarization also here. And my last point, I think I'm maybe out of time also, but this question of disengagement, I think that Maidan, for its ordinary participants, but not ordinary also for activists, for everyone who was there, it was an intense and emotionally strong, actually, engagement. Engagement, and I showed you the example of Yevgen, this construction worker that empowered, you know, people also, provided them the sense that they can do something, they can change things. And I think after this kind of involvement, it's really difficult to quit this role of active citizen and to disengage. I do believe in idiosyncrasy, of course, of trajectories, but it happens that many of my respondents, they didn't disengage. They find new forms of engagement. Some of them, right after Maidan, because political process took over this revolutionary path, they became, I call them, the guards of the revolution, because they pushed revolutionary agendas through street politics by organizing demonstrations, and they acted because Maidan remained, the occupation continued, actually, after the end of the revolution. Occupation continued several months, and so they acted with those old self-defense groups and organized different protests to push this agenda, especially the question of lustration of the previous regime officials, of corrupt judges, and even policemen also. But with the beginning of the war in Donbass, the first of all annexation of Crimea, and then beginning of war of Donbass, this active citizenship actually embodies right now, according to me, in volunteering, in different forms of volunteering. This phenomenon that developed also in Ukraine in spring 2014, when people through their solidarity with front lines started to supply goods, food, equipment, either to front lines or to help IDPs, internally displaced persons, right after the conflict, or another type also volunteering, taking care of wounded people. And of course, we may think that taking care of a wounded, it's not citizenship, because citizenship is more about voting and protest politics. But I would argue that no, actually, we through those examples we can apprehend. Through practices also, this new form of citizenship, and I think that Maidan was founded also in fostering this sense of belonging to a citizen's community. I'll stop here, thank you.
Thank you very much for this great presentation and for keeping the time too. After the emotion, we had a great contribution on the architecture of the spontaneous organization you find in this kind of mobilization and also its transformation. So thank you very much. And now I give the now next talk is Pablo Yusel. Vamos. Oh, sorry, I don't speak Spanish. Vamos lentos porque vamos lejos. Towards dialogical understanding of Spain's 15 MRs.
Is this good, the sound? Is it good? Yeah. What does lejos mean? Lejos means far. We go slowly because we're going ever so far, right? It's basically what I will be talking about. But okay, I'm gonna actually read some reflections that I've been writing to try and give you a sense of what it is that is happening in Spain since 2011. And so the question that I've been working on is, what is the phenomenon that calls itself 15M? This is a question I have tried to answer with 4 years of research immersed within 15M and engaged in dialogues of reciprocal elucidation with 213 individuals being 15M in 23 different cities in the Spanish state. I actually traveled for 6 months living in a van and just spending my time with them in every single city that I could basically afford to go. As a small clarification, throughout the presentation, I will be predominantly speaking of the Spanish state rather than about Spain. This is because during the research, numerous interviewees, especially in the regions of Catalonia, Asturias, the Basque Country, Galicia, and Andalusia, express rejection to the term Spain because they see the Spanish state as an imperial force imposing itself on them as peoples and nations. Numerous interviewees did not identify with Spain as a nation or a country and speak always of the Spanish state. So following this clarification, let me continue with some of my perceptions in regards to 15M, following this dialogical exploration I've been carrying out. As a way to start, it is important to remember that this experience, which we refer to as 15M, at its peak moment of public exposure, counted an estimated 6 to 8.5 million people in the Spanish state that identified with it and some way got involved in co-creating it. Although seemingly spontaneous, the complex and network multiplicity of 15M reveal deep roots, as in different paths, and roots, as in different traditions nurturing it, in over a century of collective practices of dissent. In addition, the appearance of 15M has revealed what Boaventura de Sosa Santos speaks about when he suggests that different cultures and the social practices they ground have different rules of social time, different temporal codes. The temporal code of 15M is revealed through one of their most prominent mantras: vamos lentos porque vamos lejos. We go ever so slowly because we are going on forever. I think remembering this mantra is very important if we are to understand what those being 15M are about and how their way of being differs with that of others who claim to be continuing from where 15M left off. I'm thinking here of party movements such as Podemos. 15M may have made possible the emergence of Podemos. Nevertheless, Podemos is very different to 15M. Organizations such as Podemos are not the meaning or significance of 15M, nor the aim or raison d'etre of those being 15M. 15M is not an instrumental mobilization in order to gain power over through a party movement like Podemos. This has been the assumption of mobilization theorists and of numerous political theories throughout the almost 4 years in which the Spanish state has been affected by a 15M climate. The list of political theories working along these lines is ample. But counter to these assumptions, when 15M transgendered sisters were asked what 15M is, the majority of responses reflected the following: 15M is a mode of being in the world with others and exercising power together. So let us continue thinking with and about this 15M mode of being in the world. I will address the rise of Podemos towards the end of this presentation, but for now, let me just try and shed some light on the phenomenon that calls itself 15M. 4 years ago, on May 15th, 2011, we witnessed in the Spanish state something that was quickly and popularly referred to as 15M or the Indignados. Since May 15th of 2011, 15M has had a tremendous impact on the way a large part of the Spanish population understands itself and its response abilities, ability to respond, and rights. In addition, 15M has affected the way in which a large part of the Spanish population understands its environment and those living beings with whom said environment is co-created and co-inhabited. Since May 15th, 2011, 15M has altered the way in which many individuals engage with their spiritual, environmental, social, political, and economic realities. It has affected their ways of thinking about family, about love, community, hierarchy, patriarchy, imperialism, colonialism, capitalism, socialism, humanism, communism, anarchism, feminism, the environment, debt, government, monarchy, history, food, art, the private, the public, and the common. These and many other ideas and realities have been and are currently being re-engaged. 15M has affected thinking, feeling, intuition, and action in an unquantifiable number of ways. 15M is something collective and personal, global and local, theoretical and practical, revolutionary and reformist, progressive and conservative, civic and civil. 15M has a temporality which encompasses past, present, and future, and works within and without societal structures of power. 15M is movement. 15M is transformation. And 15M is hope. 15M is alive. It's a multiplicity of ideas. It's a constant mutation of something that escapes definition. There can be no exact statement or description to capture the full nature, scope, or meaning of 15M. Yet 15M is easily recognizable and can be genealogically explored through its ideas, its relationality, and its actions. 15M is a multiplicity of knowledges. 15M is dialogical. It is new and old. It is wise and ignorant, vanguard and rearguard, mainstream and marginal, migrant and immigrant. 15M is rupture and continuity, destruction and construction. 15M is internal and external, inclusive and exclusive. 15M is utopian and grounded, virtual and real, intuitive and analytical, spontaneous and planned. 15M is legal, illegal, and alter-legal. It is all this and much more. Since May 15th of 2011, across the country, the network forces that together constitute 15M have been organizing and making decisions collectively through popular assemblies organized in city, town, and village squares. People have stopped families from being evicted from repossessed homes. Abandoned public or repossessed buildings have been occupied to host homeless families. Police has been stopped from arresting illegal immigrants in poor neighborhoods. People have attempted to stop the closing of public hospitals following drastic public spending cuts. Neighborhood committees have been organized aimed at rebuilding the social fabric destroyed by the last two decades of neoliberal economics. Boycotts have mushroomed, fiscal disobedience has intensified, legal persecution of those deemed responsible for the crisis has been initiated, financed through popular initiatives such as crowdfunding, and all this has been taking place while communal libraries, websites, TV channels, radios, magazines, newspapers, vegetable gardens, schools, hospitals, villages, alternative currencies, and assembly-based political parties have been created as cooperative examples of nonviolent mutual aid. These activities clearly reveal 15M as a way of being in the world with fellow living beings. In this sense, 15M presents us with some hints, mostly in the forms of questions and explorations, regarding what happens to us as human beings and spiritual, environmental, social, economic, and political agents when we engage and articulate collectively, horizontally, and nonviolently different knowledges. Knowledges that exist in addition to and outside of established hegemonic and dogmatic belief systems. It is in 15M's abundant questioning and exemplary explorations that I see its transformative power. What Spain has been immersed in since May 15th of 2011 looks like a complex, mutating, and dialogic, collective and cooperative, agonistic and transformative climate that many refer to as el clima 15M. 15M climate is a term coined by Spanish philosopher Amador Fernández Savater. From within this climate, in essence, what has flourished in Spain is that many people have begun to call into question, subject to public discussion, negotiation, and modification, hopefully transformation, the current social, political, and economic system. A manifestation of people ourselves taking the initiative to exercise power together and act in concert to bring about change through a series of complementary methods, self-organization, civil disobedience, protesting, acting in a wide variety of loosely coordinated ways, discussing, cooperating, negotiating among diverse members and subgroups, negotiating with the government and the different police forces and media, negotiating with different trade unions, political parties, and social organizations of numerous types, setting up committees, pushing for legal and constitutional reforms, seeking changes to democratic accountability, and building a truly social and economic democracy from the ground up in a nonviolent manner. A clear example of what Canadian political theorist James Tully presents as the activities of self-governing people changing the way they are governed. The outcome of this process for the country has been that the cultura de la transición, the idea of what is Spain constructed during the country's transition to democracy and reinforced until today, has been broken. With this rupture, somehow, the idea of the possible and preferable has mutated, transformed, and expanded. With the occupation of squares in 2011, different demoi were out, and it turned out we shared a common inwardness, as Catalan philosopher Santi López Petit puts it. What we were saying to ourselves in our solitude or in our restricted groups, many others were thinking and feeling. As Thomas Merton put it, writing from his monastery, our seclusion was not separating us and disconnecting us, but instead created a stronger connection with the other, a silent communion. This became apparent in the assemblies held in the squares. On May 15th of 2011, we came out of our halls and we broke the pact of silence agreed upon by elites during the country's transition to democracy. 15M interrupted normality. It opened up a space from which we could experiment with each other. It became, as Fernández Sabater describes it, a vital experience, which in act, in practice, questioned the essence of neoliberalism. We stopped competing, and we gave each other the gift of taking charge in common of something common. With the squares, our contemporary societies acquired momentarily a semblance of an extraordinary democratic life, a moment in which thousands of self-sustaining little villages organized by inhabitant assemblies and ran themselves with no relationship to the king. After dispersing from public squares, the strange multiplicity that is 15M is in constant transformation. In this sense, it has shown its transformative abilities through a series of multilogs and collective actions aimed at working through and with recurring and newly risen agonisms. Through this process, diverse groups of people have continued to challenge and resist the dominant norms and institutions of Spanish society. By their exemplar, they have continued to present the country's demos with the challenge of whether other social, political, economic, environmental, and spiritual alternatives are possible and or actual. Fernández Sabater suggests thinking about 15M as the earthquake that shook the foundations and seeing the events that followed as aftershocks. With this imaginary in mind, we can see how following the squares, the collective present known as 15M dispersed the two neighborhoods, a virtuous confluence followed with movements that had been active or were beginning, the PA, the platform of those affected by mortgages, the mareas, the different sectorial tides that developed, the occupied social centers, etc. During this wave of politicization, party movement Podemos was born. In early 2014, Podemos presented itself to the European elections, expecting one seat in the European Parliament, and they got five. And the party found itself at the center of media attention. Their initial program had many invites to 15M, but as the months progressed, the program softened with the excuse that winning the center of the electoral vote required such a move. For example, by the time of the regional elections for autonomous governments on the 24th of May of this year, a proposal for a universal basic income became simply providing aid for those who were unemployed. In those elections, Podemos obtained 15% of the vote. As things stand today, in the electoral game, we have now a populist right-wing option, Ciudadanos, and the media attacks to Podemos, together with the rise of this right-wing party, have weakened the idea that Podemos is the force to be contested in the general elections coming up December 20th. While Chantal Mouffe, in an interview with Pablo Iglesias, the general secretary of Podemos, suggests that in Spain and in Europe as a whole, the struggle is between a populism of the right and a populism of the left, and with Pablo Iglesias saying that taking government is not having the power, but is the only thing that is left, other sectors are betting on different paths. For example, as Ángel Calle Callado, professor at the University of Córdoba, suggests, municipalist currents have won local governments, who have won local governments, do not see the possibility of an electoral process separated from the social process that support it. In post-15M Spain, thinking about politics does not generally revolve around questioning the importance of state institutions. But there is certainly a question about whether a politics which assumes a central and referential state institutions is a politics capable of addressing the challenges we face as we attempt to radically transform our society. This is certainly an aspiration which is repeatedly claimed by people working from within Podemos, from within monopolist alternatives, and from within still active 15M networks. Following the experience of 15M, we seem to have found ourselves in what Leonidas Martín calls a space in which everything has been resituated. What he means by this is that you look at something and it looks as it has always looked, but everything is different. Visibly, not much has really changed, but the construction has changed. And in this sense, 15M has affected what we are looking at when thinking about politics in Spain. Clearly, there are still unresolved tensions between 15M and the new forms of politics in the electoral arena. But holding hands is necessary in order to overcome shared challenges. As Catalan philosopher Marina Garcés puts it, to try and keep alive that tension found in the living unity between opposites. Podemos violates the means-end relationship essential to 15M beingness in two very specific ways. First, it mistakenly claims it can bring about power with organization or continue power with organizing by means of power over methods. And second, it acts in crisis time rather than in the ever so slow temporality of being the change in each step that we take that has been the key feature of being 15M. With the promotion of its general secretary, Pablo Iglesias, what Podemos seems to have brought into the contemporary Spanish politics is the figure of the condottiere, the figure which Antonio Gramsci, drawing from Machiavelli, describes as the person who represents plastically and anthropomorphically the symbol of the collective will, a figure which Gramsci himself suggests will not create another world, but simply duplicate the present, even if victorious. Can I have one more minute?
Yes.
Thank you. Hannah Arendt suggests in On Violence that it is possible that a more democratic form of ongoing, accountable, and revocable by the base form of representation can come into being. Nevertheless, in order for this to be the case, civic, horizontal, and civil, vertical organizations need to be understood as being complementary. If this happens, they can together preclude the iron law of oligarchy. Nevertheless, Podemos is revealing a different behavior in its practices. In this sense, it's my view that if the current process continues without being checked and redirected, it risks distancing the Spanish demos from those visions of possible futures that 15 individuals have been enacting for over 5 years, visions which transmit a possible paradigm shift in the way in which our societies function and are understood. If we are to democratize our hollowed-out democratic institutions, the vicious cycle perpetuated by initiatives like Podemos is going to need to turn into a virtuous cycle of power with social transformation. Until then, it seems as if we might be living in what Hannah Arendt describes as the time of the no longer and the not yet, what she explains as a kind of historic no man's land. In that time, the decline of the old and the birth of the new coexist. In this sense, our old ways might be blinding us and depriving us of enjoying the leap forward humanity perhaps made with the beingness of 15M. The collective silences of 15M of May 15, 2011 marked a tipping point in our hegemonic understandings of democracy, representation, and politics. Podemos, on the other hand, could be the materialization of a regression towards our old ways. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Pablo, for this great presentation. I have to say that I'm sorry, Pablo, I forgot to introduce you before you talk, so I should do it now. He's a brilliant political scientist trained in Canada. Thank you very much for your talk. I won't do the same mistake now, so our next speaker is Perrine Poupin. She's a PhD student at the EHSS. And you're going to talk about old and new, what it means to become an activist strategist in a public base.
Thank you. So excuse me for my bad English, for poor English, because I wanted to speak in a common language to be understood. So I will speak more as a reflexive activist or something like that than a researcher, because it was the previous framework of our conference to be activist. So, and I understood that there are a lot of scholars, so I will follow the line. So I will say I and we and not they. So, because I had already prepared last week a presentation for this conference, but yesterday and today, I listened very carefully all the contribution, and I took into account the ways of your ways to address these events. So, as a strategist activist, as I say, in protest, who decides to act according the situation, I will act today like according the situation of the audience to speak a common language. So, yes. Because listening people during 2 days, lots of contribution have some points in common, and as we don't have so many time to make discussion, so I will occupy my presentation with like a response to your presentation. So no kind of reflexivity if it's not like an insult for the colloquium. So I don't want to catalogue action in country I know, like in Russia or Ukraine, and I don't want to make a chronology, because in 50 minutes it's kind of very, very strong to listen. So about common points. So to make who I am. I am finishing a PhD on the EHSS, and I was studying protest in Moscow with a video camera. It was before the big demonstration in 2011-12, but it was like prehistory of this protest, and I think it's interesting to see those protests as a moment of political life and not to cut everything and to say, oh, it's like new and let's forget like old political forces and let's forget history and so on. So I will explain my point of view. So first, in the street occupation in Moscow or in Kyiv, and I understood in other countries, on the square, there are very different different people, different groups, different political, religious, territorial groups, different tactics, different conception of legitimate violence, different ways of people to meet, to speak politically together, different way of describing things in words and pictures. So it's very important to say it's diversity, and even it's like political strategic way to present ourselves, like unanimity in those kind of space. As a researcher and as like old activist people, we know in fact in reality it's diversity, and maybe to be honest, it's to describe this diversity, not to like say, oh, it was unanimity, and after there was like Muslim brotherhood or some kind of political force, she appears, and after unanimity was destroyed. So it's to accept this obvious way of describing. So maybe one task for activists, who is open to other people, of course, not like sect. And for like a researcher, it's to make very thin description of micropolitics of the square. Who is there, and to feel why people are there. It's not just for unanimity. A lot of people have a different way, and it's not problematic. So, for instance, in Kyiv and in Moscow, we can saw lot. Enfin, we saw lot of friction and conflicts between the group. At various points of on the square, so different forces between political groups and between political groups and so-called ordinary people. So, for instance, in Kyiv, in Maidan, the opposition, it's the same in Moscow. If there is a lot of people in the street, opposition, like traditional opposition in Moscow or in Kyiv, or like Russia, Ukraine, they build a big, big scene, like a big scene, like theater, but for political purpose. And so they control the entrance of the scene, and you can't just speak on the scene if you don't have a relation with traditional opposition. But it's not question of just a scene. It's the problem, and you catch it when you are making movies. He organized the space, the sound space, the political space, the representation of space. And for instance, in Kyiv, all day long you could listen very sound noise from the scene. So it was problematic for people to speak sometimes, because there was those slogans, religion anthems, who organized the time and the space of common space. So even we can say, okay, but opposition do what he wants and people do what they want, you can't afford to see that there are struggle on sound, there are struggle on space. So it's a key fact. So in I didn't put the time, okay. So it's important to see, even in the framework of spontaneity, that there are some special facts that are depriving or helps people to build spontaneous horizontal connection. So ethnography as a method. So ethnography, it's video methods. It's to force ourselves as a researcher or activist to take the time to look, because we already know everything sometimes with interpretation. I say obvious things, and it's quite insulting to say that, but I can say for myself, the section, it's to La Place, l'expérience de soi, that video, it's a kind of school of patience, to take time to look. And even in like a so obvious place of like an unanimity, you take the time to see the people, to how the space is constructed. So during today's we speak a lot about spontaneity, and I don't want to say I'm against spontaneity. I saw it, but sometimes it can be like quite a neoliberal language to say, okay, people, they don't want to speak about politics. They just want to go to the square, and after they go to home, and they are. It's like politics. It's now like that in the square. So we don't have to search for other things, not to construct other things, and just to go to the square and after go back home. So, yes, because from spontaneity, from the first day of spontaneity, after you can think about infrastructure or some, maybe it's a job for like an activist and a researcher to organize spaces to, spaces where people could take the, where people could learn to speak in public, and a place where they can speak, because in a crowd you don't speak. So it was the point in Kyiv, for instance, in those tents in the center of the city of the Maidan to organize speaking in public for people who don't have any experience of this, and it's not just to like demagogic things to give like a word to people, but it's kind of a legitimation for people that they understand that they can speak, because even if some people like Yves Cohen, he says that it's not the moment for leadership now. For instance, in Kyiv, if you just see the crowd, you say, okay, there is no leader, so it's the end of the epoch of leadership. But if you listen to people, people say we need leaders, but our leaders now, they are very bad. So we need good leaders. We need good opposition. So it means that people don't considerate that they can do some, they can speak about politics. They need someone who speak for them. So maybe one point is to make some like space where people can feel that they can speak. It's quite maybe a bit like naive, maybe in France to say that, but in our like countries, it's not so naive. So yes, so I don't know, maybe to finish, no?
Couple of minutes.
Yes, couple of minutes. So we can say that the square, it's like a snapshot of vitality of political life, because I understand that in Turkey, in different countries, we can check if how like activists or people, they can speak each other. So it's interesting to see the square as a like moment of like political life too, in a country, and in media, in different way. And another point to finish, it's we saw like in Egypt, I understood that in Tunisia, in Kyiv, in Moscow, that traditional opposition party and traditional movement, they have caused a lot of problems in every country. And yes, for instance, in Kyiv, a lot of people say that they hate opposition party who build this scene, but thanks to their presence in the square, they could hate someone and not to kill each other. Maybe I'm not so clear, but okay. So to finish, it was the name of the contribution, as a reflexive animal, I don't know. It was to rethink maybe of activist posture, because activist before it was like to say some slogans, to say, to interpret all the society, la la la. No, maybe it's to build in those spontaneous movement a way and a place to give the people to, to give the like the space for people to speak together. In Kyiv, for instance, in tents, it was very practical things. For instance, to stand around, to stand in a circle and to give the like we do in like academic circle, to give the word and just listen each other, So it's like kind of competence of academic and intellectual and activist, and it play a big big role in those spontaneous things which need to be continued and institutionalized. Excuse me for English.
Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation, and also to give us the feeling of what's meant to be a researcher on this kind of field, and that you have to act with other people if you want to understand how to do it, what they the way they act. We have a couple of minutes for a huge discussion with everybody, so you can use whatever language you want, and if someone doesn't understand, we will try to translate.
Thank you very much for a great panel, and Yula's and Asia's talks had for me one similar thing, that you took quite unusual vocabularies for describing these public protests, the vocabulary of emotions and the vocabulary of socialization or something like that, and these mere descriptions through the unusual lens, through the unusual vocabulary, created a new understanding for me of the of what was happening. But in the same time, I see one problematic thing, and I wonder how do you see this? When you say that okay, after the child was killed, there was more anger and also sadness. How much do you rely here on what the participants actually said about what they felt, and how you yourself at least are sure that this reflects how the others saw what was happening? I mean, did you talk to them? How many people you asked? And also, sadness or anger. Like, people have different reactions to these emotions, and some person might be sad but actually not feeling sadness. Sometimes sadness is that much that he might say, yeah, I'm kind of sad, but actually he or she doesn't have emotions at this stage for like a couple of days, and he or she just does a lot of things. And that's what I observed at Maidan also, at the critical points. We could talk about anger or sadness, but it wasn't that we really felt something. We were just super mega energetic, doing a lot of things. And how to talk about emotions in this case? How to say what these people feel? Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question to you about the citizenship. Did people really use the vocabulary of the citizenship? Because following my interviews in Moscow and some other Russian cities, these are mostly those who entered without any political experience into mobilization, into protest, and then who professionalize inside, they use normally this concept of we wish to be citizen. On the contrary, people who turn back to their houses without changing much their lifestyles, they use normally the concept which Asia evoked, we are humans. And this is the general idea that we participate here not as citizens, but like normal humans. And this idea of normality is of a big importance in the whole mobilization. We didn't discuss it much, but I think the way you presented the situation permits to speak about that. Is it really citizenship which is on the question, or that us sociologists who imply people to think that they are in the search and the seek for the citizenship? And for Perrine, I'd like to, I don't know, ask or comment the idea that we need leaders. From the interviews, what emerges more, that not really we need leaders, but we need good guys who come to the politics, who push the bad guys, and even if the good guys become bad guys in a year or in 6 months, well, in between, when they fight, we have something for us. And from time to time, I mean, it's rather cynical as a vision, but I had this quite explicitly in maybe two or three interviews and some residual forms of this vision in some other interviews. So is it which vocabulary did you have in your video? Did people really claim we need leaders, we need someone who guides us?
I also have two questions to Yulia Shukan and Perrin Popin. I was really interested with this idea of disengagement as a new engagement, and my question is: is it possible to say that a disengagement is a continuity of a political engagement, but in an apolitical way, or is it, volunteering? Is declared by your interviewees themselves as a I got lost in my question. Sorry.
I got your question.
So what I'm trying to say is it a prise de distance towards politics, or is it a continuation of a political engagement of a protest engagement in Maidan, and for Perrin, I always had this curiosity as you worked, as you said, on the prehistory of these big mobilizations of 2011 and 2012. Have you got elements of comparison? And was there something new or something au contraire, there were things that were very similar, but the scale was different. Thank you.
I have a question for Pablo. You say that Podemos is really far away from the spirit of 15M. I'm wondering whether there is an emergence some other type of organization emerged from 15M spirit in Spanish public space, because in Gizi they are in the search of another type of organization, maybe not hierarchical, not based on leadership and solidarity, based on solidarity. So do you think that there are some new types of organizations within which we can maybe do politics, another kind of politics?
One or two more questions before our first round of answer. No, there's a vice president here.
Your power is challenged, yeah.
It is a question for all of you, mm-hmm. Maybe in particular for, but a topic that I noticed that is common, quite common to all presentation, or it emerged in a lot of your presentations, is that this sense of new identity, new belonging, new community that emerge mm-hmm. from the political mobilization. I think that it's a very important issue to stress out. It is true that there is a strong collective energy, strong, a kind of effervescence collective, like Durkheim said. But I also think that is important to stress the role, the paper of the conflict inside the groups. it is quite important because it exists a lot of conflicts in a lot of differences. I refer to 15M, for instance, but it is important because there is the risk to create a reification process, an objectivation process. Like if these movements, they are all one thing, there is no difference inside. I think that there are differences inside. There are relation powers inside. It is important to ask when people speak in public. Everybody speak at the same way. Male speaks more than woman. This kind of question, no? And in this sense, I also have an ethic question. When you find that there is in your research, you find there is a kind of contradiction inside the movement, a kind of debility of the movement. How do you treat this information? Because it is difficult. It can go against the movement if you diffuse this kind of information. I don't know if I am clear.
Well, I would have just I would have the same question of than Sasha about citizenship, but about revolution and revolutionaries. Does it belong to the people? This vocabulary on the Maidan, and what was the vocabulary of the people? Would they say they are becoming revolutionaries? Mm-hmm. Because there is a question. We could get something in getting Yanukovych out or getting Ben Ali out, but there is a system still. We have to do the revolution. So what is this? What can we do with the vocabulary of revolution? And I think that we have different kind of interpretation of very different kind of events. For example, emotions is also a frame of interpretation. I was very struck of the power of this analysis of emotions to speak about the ties and the way emotions are a confirmation to belonging to a community, which is a way to think about shared emotion that make unity of a group. And maybe an analysis of Maidan would insist on activities in the dance, activities on the square, military activities, and artistic activities, and less on emotion, a little bit as Nina was suggesting. And it's the same for the question of the leader. I agree also with Sasha. The question of the leader is very complex because, you were narrating like the 19th of January 2014, there was an evening on the square, people shouting, "Lidera, lidera." We want leaders, we want leaders. And one of the same proclaimed leader who was not recognized by the Maidan Square told, but you have no leaders. And de facto, the Maidan Square could do without leader.
They should compromise.
Yeah. But after Maidan, they had a compromise with Poroshenko. But after the screening by the Maidan, there was the screening, the control of the power, and the screening for the Maidan. Of course, but yeah. No, I agree completely. But this is very complex because, and the last point is that, as a comparison to Tsisi, in Brazil, the MPL, founded in part by Lucas, the MPL, one of the principles of the MPL was to be without leader. But doing all these demonstrations, they couldn't think that there are some kind of leaders. And they have to behave but how to be a, and from that came the idea of the loss of control. We have, well, we are recognizing that we have something as a leaders, but we have to, I don't know, we have to think we must accept the idea to lose the control, which is something very interesting on this question of leadership, about leadership.
So I think your question is, how do I know what emotions they have, and how can I generalize? I think it's a very valid question. Sociologists of emotions for the social movement study this is that they look at the diaries of protesters, and what they don't necessarily have to say, I was sad that day, or I was so happy. That's not how it's analyzed, but it's more like, well, it's more subtle. It's just the way they are. There are other ways of understanding it. And I didn't really make a very, I didn't do a terrain, field work, because it's not, now, if I went out now to do a field work, it wouldn't really work, because it's been 3 years and people remember things the way they want to remember them. So most people are going to think they will have different feelings. But you can. What I did is I talked to a lot of people and read testimonies and watched visuals of it, and I came up with a sketch, which is more of a draft. It's what I think has happened. It's not. I mean, I'm sure not everyone felt the same things at the same time. It's not possible, right? But that's just what I came up with. So. And for the other question of in-group conflict, I think it's a very question. So I think it's a great topic to think about what happened in the movement, but it's very vast, and it's for another time and for another talk. But I think it's very important as well. So.
Okay. Are there other types of organizations? I think to answer that question, we have to go back to how Podemos actually gets started. So within the 15M, as they leave the squares and they move to the neighborhoods, they start discussing how to go into the institutions in a horizontal manner. That is, how do you actually go into a place that is vertical in its operation but maintaining the horizontality of 15M? And there's groups all over Spain meeting regularly to discuss this issue. And I think it's about 222 organizations are meeting very regularly, and they're making decisions on how to approach it together so that there's consensus. And in those meetings, the founders of Podemos are actually part of these meetings, right? And they had a meeting in Madrid, they'd been meeting regularly, but they had a meeting in Madrid and where all the collectives decided how to approach the thing. And the next day, Pablo Iglesias appeared on television launching Podemos as his own brand without forgetting everybody else, you know, and leaving like all the movement disactivated. Right, so like there was a project that was going to approach the institutional question, right? So that's why I'm very cautious about what Podemos actually is, right? And now, following that, there's this candidaturas de Unidad Popular, which are like candidatures that have come together to go to the municipal elections and win the local government. And in those, although Podemos has been active in them, it's been more like a mix of people from Podemos, people from other political parties more to the left of Podemos, and people in the 15M, people coming from the 15M movement. So in that space, you have the agonisms that you were seeing in 15M. I mean, because when I talk about 15M being horizontal and you know, like I never wanted to present this 15M as like this is a one set view. It's actually all the conflicts were happening in there, right? And that addresses also the question from the other person. But so I think the place where the agonisms that were present in 15M are being lived right now is in this municipal thing. And there is also a couple of anarchist attempts. Spain has a strong anarchist history, so we have to understand that. And there's a couple of very strong attempts to unite, to do basically what was happening in 1930s in Spain, is to try and create a federation of anarchists so that, you know, they can actually start, you know, although they don't believe in the institutional question, at least have a way of approaching it. So there are options. But I guess what I've been trying to reflect on is that there was a moment, it seemed, when 15M really was captivating the imaginary of the Spanish society. And that space was pushed out of that space. It was pushed out of that state from that place first by the right wing, you know, in power, by the media, by the financial world. And my argument is that people on the left, the organized left, people like Pablo Iglesias and, you know, Podemos, are actually helping destroy more that space that had been created, right? So I hope this sort of answers your question. And then if I could just address the question about tensions, I would call them conflicts, tensions within 15M. There's three tensions that I saw repeatedly in my interviewing process. And one was to do with feminists and the way they felt being left out and how sexist the dialogue was. And there was a very famous event in Puerta del Sol where someone put up a banner that said the revolution will be feminist or it will not be, and someone tore it down, and that began a whole real conflict between feminist groups and the rest of the occupation, but not only in Madrid but all across Spain. So, and that conflict remained throughout. I interviewed a lot of feminists. I made it a point to try and listen to how they had and felt within 15M, and many, you know, opted out of 15M. Many, you know, people within the feminist movement opted out of 15M. The other important agonism or tension that I saw in that repeatedly came in the interviewing process was the tension between violence and nonviolence, and how to define, you know, what violence is and what nonviolence is. And that remained throughout the whole thing. And the other one was to do with horizontality and verticality. And one of the things I noticed, though, however, which is very interesting, is that out of the people that I interviewed, I'd say 20 of them right now are actually very high political figures in Spain. You know, they weren't at the time. And they were the ones that were advocating for verticality. So in reality, what you had is some people in the 15M movement that wanted power, and they actually advocated for it, and they're getting it. But at the expense of 15M, at least the imaginary that I witnessed within 15M. So,
yes, I will address several questions. Also, if I may, a question of emotions, actually, because I'm also struggling with emotions, actually, in my different field works. I think it's very difficult to map emotions. And I try to do, actually, it in situ and through practices what's... the example I gave you, equipment, for example, in different situations. So I found that the social sciences on this question of emotion is a bit shaky knowledge. So I'm trying, you know, to cope with and to get around, actually, by focusing on different things, so to get the sense of emotion, because you're right, how to know if the grief is... we are in more grief, like, what is the degree of grief according to events? Concerning this question, Eve and Alexander, citizenship and revolutionaries as a noun. Of course, it's analytical categories. It's not indigenous categories. In 15 minutes, I just could not provide you, extracts of my interviews. But I agree with you. You mentioned the term of professionalization. Those who professionalize, and actually professionalization in street politics is also underway on Maidan. So those who professionalize, of course, use the vocabulary of citizens. Others, no, it's more, the focus is more placed on dignity. You know, it's a revolution of dignity, the terms that is used. Revolution, of course. Revolutionary, of course, is used also as an adjective, but revolutionaries as a noun, it's an analytical category. The question concerning political or political, and actually I'm also struggling with this very narrow focus on politics. Politics is like only voting and protests. I want to enlarge the focus of of politics. And I think like many works have been done in Schuessess also, you know, this question of what is political and what is civic and from civic to political. And I think that political is acting together, caring about the public goods, caring about other citizens, soldiers, and it's also those manifestations of, you know, political. That's why I try to go beyond this question of voting, because many of my respondents, they're very distrustful towards politics. They have also the sense that worse than Maidan, distrust towards politics, meaning institutional politics. But I think what they're doing, it's also about politics. So I'm trying, you know, to apprehend this politics from the below, from their practices, and go beyond just this narrow idea of voting and protest as being institutional politics or street politics. The question of unity, unity, diversity, of course, Maidan is very diverse. Of course, there are many conflicts also. And I think I would even say that depending on the experiences we had and the microgroups we have evolved on Maidan, we can have different accounts actually of Maidan, of what happened, and explain also of different factors. I use this category of unity. Unity is a you know, is a construction, something that is aimed at through discourses, through circulation of senses on Maidan. But of course, there is diversity. There is conflict, power relations between there are three opposition leaders, three political parties, and of course there is also conflict there, and the conflict was evoked also in this presentation. Leftist group, for example, that were just you know, expelled from Maidan and not admitted physically their presence as a group on Maidan, and maybe just one remark concerning leaders. Maybe in relation with Ukrainian Maidan, we tend to think in terms of, when you told lidera, we tend to think in terms of, you know, one of those three leaders, actually, opposition leaders. But I would say that it happened that my previous research project was on MPs in Ukraine. And I've been during Maidan also, you know, with some of the MPs, and I would say that they were leaders very close to people. And people accepted them as leaders, not, of course, as a political leader, the one who would lead the revolution, but there were some MPs very close to also to ordinary citizens that protected them in courts, in police offices, and et cetera. And I think it's kind of multiplicity also of leaders, even talking about, when I talk about opposition MPs and opposition leaders. Stop here.
Are we finished? So about, Sasha Bigboff, when you say about like leaders, and again, there is different language. For instance, maybe in Moscow, cynical, like some circles, they will say goodbye, bad guys. But again, we have to see all the like spectrum of lexicality about leadership. Maybe someone will not pronounce the name leader, but it's the same relation. So it's not very diverse. But we, for instance, in Kyiv, in Maidan, in different place, it was like typically leadership. After about prehistory of Moscow protests, the committee who organized the protest in Balotnaya stuff, it was the same people I studied in like a coalition. So it was the same people with the same tactics. They look at the coalition like instrumentalists. We will not construct a discussion, but we are there to fight Putin. And it was you could meet anti-fascists with fascists, and 2 days before they were killing each other. It was not 2 years before. So it's not to construct the free space to speak. It was the same. The idea of rationalization of political competence in the both of the like committee. And to finish about the conflict, I don't think so. It's not debility. Like it can be. No, for instance, France, we say conflict. It's politics. It's socialization. Why conflict in other country? It's bad. It's unanimity for non-Western people and politics conflict for people. No, if democracy can begin it when there is conflict, but when people can listen and like speak their opinion with. So I don't see problem with the conflict in Maidan. I understand it was not. I agree and I say that conflict is not problem, but the problem is to make spaces when you can like speak. You can clarify your position when you can listen people. So it's a problem. It's when you have conflict, you have big emotion, but you don't have public space to speak about that. It's a problem. But the conflict in nature, it's not problematic. It's the beginning of politics when you understand that we are different individuals, different like world, different world of view, but we can share. And the same in France after like. Those terrorist attacks, to not to cut all the links between people, but to learn to speak physically with people, which has social territorial space of living completely different. So it's conflict. It's not the point. Thank you.
Oui, donc je trouve que je trouve que ces quatre exposés étaient absolument fascinants et très stimulant sur le plan intellectuel et au niveau des concepts que cela véhicule. Alors, je suis tout à fait d'accord avec ce qui vient d'être dit sur la difficulté en sciences sociales d'objectiver les émotions. Dès lors qu'on aurait envie de savoir si ce que disent les émotions, c'est ce que pensent les gens. Si c'est ça, je crois qu'effectivement, c'est un vain mot et qu'on n'y arrivera jamais. En revanche, il existe une véritable sociologie ou une histoire des émotions, c'est ce que vous avez fait, que je trouve extrêmement intéressant, qui sont les émotions qui sont globalement acceptées dans une collectivité à un moment donné. Et celles-ci traduisent quelque chose de l'espace social, au fond, que les gens les vivent vraiment ou pas. C'est-à-dire que même lorsqu'ils les vivent, on ne peut pas être complètement convaincu qu'ils sont authentiques. Vous savez, le métier de psychanalyste, il leur faut, ces braves gens, plus de 15 ans pour comprendre ce que disent leurs patients, la plupart du temps. Donc, ce n'est pas en faisant une enquête comme ça là qu'on va savoir la réalité du sentiment. En revanche, l'idée que l'émotion, et non pas le sentiment, est perceptible dans une enquête ethnographique ou dans une enquête sociologique, dès lors que ces émotions sont collectivement validées, pour moi, me semble être un outil extrêmement précieux dans les sciences sociales. Alors, ce que je disais tout à l'heure en introduction par rapport à ce que vous aviez dit sur Freud, c'est que vous connaissez tous la théorie freudienne, que ça soit la psychologie des foules, le malaise dans la civilisation et autres, avec cette idée selon laquelle une foule en liberté serait une foule nécessairement dangereuse et inorganisée en quête d'un chef, d'un leader qui viendrait finalement la guider là où elle n'aurait pas envie d'aller, puisque finalement chacun abdiquerait de son surmoi au profit de ce leader. Je crois que ça fait longtemps, du moins je l'espère, que cette thèse, on ne peut plus y croire. Mais jusqu'à présent, on ne pouvait plus y croire intellectuellement. Aujourd'hui, on a des outils objectifs pour ne pas y croire. Parce qu'on voit bien que c'est très très différent ce qui se passe. Et qu'il peut y avoir des foules comme ça, mais qu'il y a surtout des modalités d'organisation qui peuvent, alors Yves le sait bien mieux, qui peuvent se passer de l'autorité du chef, mais qui surtout sont susceptibles de produire dans l'éphémère quelque chose d'une réalité politique nouvelle. Et l'imaginaire qui se crée autour de cela est tout sauf une illusion. Alors, pour revenir à Freud et dire deux mots là-dessus, je crois que ce que Freud a voulu dire à son époque, c'était au fond d'essayer de valider la place de l'inconscient à un niveau au-delà de l'individu. Maintenant que nous savons, du moins je le sais, que l'inconscient existe, on n'a plus besoin d'imaginer qu'il forge l'ensemble de la société. On n'a plus besoin d'une métapsychologie sociale pour penser le social. Par contre, on peut tout à fait s'intéresser aussi à des objets qui, jusque-lors, étaient réservés au champ de la psychologie, comme les émotions, pour se dire, mais non, il n'y a pas de privilège à la psychologie ou à la psychanalyse, aller les investiguer, et on n'est pas obligé de les penser tels que la psychanalyse ou les psychologues les pensent. On doit leur donner une stature tout à fait sociologique ou philosophique ou anthropologique, comme vous voulez, et je trouve que vos quatre exposés en témoignent largement, donc merci mille fois. Voilà.